Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who was hoping to have a bridge named after him, sort of. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much. Hello, my finest friends. Thank you very much. Welcome back. It's series 26 of Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Though I was talking to the original Paul McCartney the other day, the one who died in the car crash in 1966. Not the rubbish replacement who wrote "Get Back in 3 minutes," that prick. The real Paul McCartney would have taken his time over that and made it good. Anyway, the original Paul McCartney calls it Relustibus. I don't know if that's going to catch on. So yes, a new series, we're back. We haven't been cancelled yet. Still possible. And a new notebook is a Jurassic World. Ooh, yeah, it's pretty cool. Jurassic. I'm still trying to picture a Jurassic World film where nothing goes wrong and everyone just looks at the dinosaurs. Is it just old age? And like the zombie films, they just kill all the zombies and make society nice again. Am I the only one who wants that? I find it too tense. Look, we've got some fantastic guests coming up in this series. I mean, even just next week, we've got Fern Brady, but there's... some of it sold out. Tim Key and Josh Widdicombe on the whatever's 7 days away from now. On the 6th of March, announcing this for the first time, you can go to and buy tickets if you're in the theatre. Mark Gatiss will be... one of the guests on the 6th of March, so do book ahead for that. 13th of March is Sarah Millican and Jordan Gray. And the 20th of March, we've got Suggs from Off of Madness. It's going to be... Come on. I mean, the room is going to be full of men in their 50s and 60s. But it's going to be great. Sadly, I wanted to give a little shout out to Terry Hall, who sadly died last year. But I'm sure we will talk about Terry with Suggs as well. For the 31st consecutive year, I am not nominated for anything at the British Comedy Awards. So thank you for that. I was on the long list. The podcast welcome was on the long list. A couple of nerds in the anoraks coming in there. You can all laugh. You're all wearing them. I was on the longest, but I didn't get voted. It was a shame. I haven't been for 31 years to the British Comedy Awards. But then I realised that it's voted for by the public, so my failure to get nominated is your fault, you fucking cunt. However, I am, more importantly, I'm attempting to get a bridge in Great Yarmouth named after me. There's the North that Council has done a poll for a new bridge in Great Yarmouth, a place I don't think I've ever been. I don't think I've ever played there. They've got multiple choice, and it's online, and you're allowed to vote as many times as you want. And I don't think that many people will be voting in this one, so I think my nerds might come through. So the choices are the Britannia Bridge. That's not a good name, is it? That's no good. The Queen's Gate. I mean, it's not even a gate, it's a bridge, so that one's not going to... That's rubbish. The Yare Bridge, which I think is... sort of pirates, the Yarra Bridge. I think that's that for them. King's Bridge without an apostrophe, so that can't be. And Herring Bridge. I can't believe they put that in. So I will go to the opening if it's at Herring Bridge, and try and do a speech. 31st of January is the deadline on that. So Google it if you're watching live, and go and join in and vote for that. That would be lovely. Oh, and people in the theatre. There are some buckets for the Red Cross. The theatre did a fantastic benefit for Ukraine on last Saturday. And so if you would like to give some money to that tonight, there are buckets on the bars. Anyway, let's crack on. We've got a brand new series. Fantastic returning guests. No one thought this would ever happen. He's probably best known... I think this is too good, so I'm going to do two. He's probably best known as Wheatley in Portal 2, though it turns out that is a really big deal. So he's also best known as the man with a broken leg in Run, Fat Boy, Run, which we may have talked about last time. Will you please welcome the incredible Stephen Merchant, ladies and gentlemen. Stephen Merchant. Thank you. Come in. Pick up there's a mic. There, beautiful. Stephen Merchant.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming. I think everyone wants to thank you for coming back.
Well, we're already off to a good start. You didn't introduce me as a paedophile. So that's a win as far as I'm concerned.
That's one up.
What's that, sir?
It's one up, isn't it?
Yeah,
I want to apologise. I was a very immature, young, 46-year-old man when you last came on. And now I am 55 and I'm a lot more mature.
Yeah.
I did a podcast recently with Sally Phillips, who I used to go out with, and we split up and it was a little bit difficult. And then she came and did a podcast and it was a reconciliation.
So that's nice.
So I'm hoping that this will...
Yeah.
It would be similar.
Why did you and Sally break up? Did you call her a paedophile and then... and then insult some of her work and generally make the atmosphere strange, or...?
Pretty much. It's pretty much.
Can I ask you what your perception is of our last encounter? Because I'm interested to know what your take is.
Well, I was...
Because I've never listened to it, so I don't have an objective opinion. I only have a sense memory of it.
Yeah. We did cut some bits out, Rich Steve.
Oh, yeah. Did you? Right. You cut out the awkward stuff, so it's about 4 minutes long. So what is your memory of it? You seem to be... Why are you evading the question?
I that night, very unusually, we recorded two podcasts in the same night. And Simon Pegg was the other guest, you may remember. So it was quite a big deal. We had two big Hollywood superstars. Yeah. I'm being nice. One of whom... No.
And I was really worried about upsetting Simon because I thought he, you know, you and I spent a bit of time at gigs and stuff. And I was worried, I hadn't seen Simon for a while, and I was worried about being inappropriate with him.
Yeah.
And so I'd concentrate really hard on being good with him. And then you came on, and I don't know what happened. I kind of lost my mind a little bit.
That's it, is it?
Yeah.
That's the apology, is it?
There was also a joke I think you took the wrong way that I meant to, as a joke against myself, which I think you... I think that was one of the moments it sort of... It turned a bit...
Let me tell you...
You're just trying to bring it up again and so we have...
Let me tell you my perception.
Yeah, okay, you give me your perception.
My feeling was that I had gone back to stand-up comedy after a long time and you were very, very supportive in that. And I saw you on the comedy scene and you were very helpful and you even had lunch with me one time and you gave me lots of good tips and clubs to try out material and things like that. And then you said, would you come down and do my podcast? And I had nothing to promote and I had no reason to come other than... being, you know, thanking you in a sense for your generous help with the return to stand-up. And so I, you know, tooled down thinking this will be a nice, fun showbiz chat. And then you just went really weird. and sort of, it was odd. And then I think you were, then we came off and you sensed that there was an energy. And then you said, oh, sometimes when I'm on stage, I play a character. And I thought, oh, do you fucking Ali G? Because you didn't mention it to me beforehand. And this character's very similar to you. No funny voices. So, inevitably, it was a strange encounter.
It was a strange encounter. And I felt very bad. I don't like to upset guests. Well, it's happened a couple... It's happened a couple of times. We might talk about one of the other guests later. But I felt very bad for about a week, and then I got over it. Yeah, that's fine. Are we going to be okay for the rest of this one?
Oh, listen, please. I haven't thought about it since. So, which of my projects do you want to slag off to start with, or do you just... We'll build to what you
we'll
don't
build
like.
To, we'll yeah, build to what you don't like. Yeah. We'll start. Well, let's talk about Portal 2 first of all, which I haven't played, but I understand that Wheatley is pretty. I saw a man talking about it in a video.
Yeah.
So you played a sort of a sort of camera robot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I play a sort of giant floating eyeball
that
guides you around a virtual world. And I've also not played the game, so can't expand much on it from there. I don't really know what happens. I know people are big fans of the game and they like it. And someone made me a knitted toy version of the character once. And people have drawn fan art and stuff. And so it's very well loved, I think.
Yeah. But that's why it wasn't a good... It wasn't a good... But, the problem with you, Stephen...
Yeah.
Is you've been very successful right from the start. So you haven't usually I can pick out something embarrassing that someone's done.
Okay. But
to be honest, it should have just said the last time you appeared on this.
Yeah. But how's it been going since then?
It's been all right. It's been good. Yeah. I think if anything, it helped legend of the podcast.
Yeah, because that was early days, wasn't it? I think you'd only done about 30 podcasts.
Yeah, I think there was a few. It was maybe for the third series, but they were short series. Yeah, so yeah, it's been going on. I'm still doing it.
Well, I think congratulations to you. Well done, mate.
Still here 10 years on. You've been
terrific.
Off. Thank you.
No, 10 years is... Yeah, no, 10 years is fantastic. And that's what I like to do. Every 10 years, I like to come out, give up an evening to sit with you while you insult me. So here we are again. It's great. No, you haven't insulted me.
Not yet, but no.
We're building
time. Give me time.
Yeah.
Give me time. It should be fun. Let's talk about John Cleese. This is quite interesting. You're a big fan of John Cleese as a young man.
Yes. Big fan of John Cleese.
You've never met... Have you met him yet?
Never met
John Cleese.
No. My parents got close to Cleese once. They were on a cruise and Cleese was giving a talk on the cruise And they knew I was big Cleese fans, and they thought they'd go along and get his book signed and say, you know, Steve Merchant, you know, it's our son and he's a big fan of you. But it was my parents, so they went, they're on a cruise, remember, for 10 days. They went on the wrong night because there's so much else to do on a cruise. And so they missed him, but they very sweetly managed to get a message to him. And they came, and then they videoed this answer phone message that he left in their cabin. And when I went to see them, when they came back, they played it for me very excitedly. And it's great because it's like this kind of shaky camera footage. And they're like, is it on, Ron? Is it on? Yeah. And they play this message, and Cleese comes on the message, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry you missed the gig, but are you, you know, are you Stephen Merchant's parents? And because I'm a big fan of his work, I'm happy to sign a book and da 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 da. And that was, isn't that lovely of him?
It is lovely.
That was as close as we got to.
I'm surprised you haven't met. I mean, you've been moving in those sort of circles. I'm sort of surprised you hadn't met him before, but you're sort of happy not to have met. Because he's from Weston-super-Mare, isn't he?
Well, he's Weston-super-Mare. He was very tall, and obviously he was used his physicality in his comedy. And I think when I was growing up, that seemed like a good thing to sort of model. There weren't a lot of very tall comedians to model yourself on, you know what I mean? And I tried a bit of sort of Norman Wisdom, but I didn't have the sort of physique for it. There's a reference for the kids. And so Cleese was always a big hero. Yeah, definitely. But I never met him. No. Have you met him?
No, I haven't. I want to get him on here. He's been, you know, he's a slightly controversial figure.
Oh, is he?
He goes on GB News now.
Oh, is he?
So you'd think I could get him on here. We've got more viewers than he has. But, you know, he sort of complains about, you know, not being on TV anymore and stuff.
And what's your view on the kind of don't meet your heroes?
Well, I met Michael Palin was nearly always my favourite Python. I did like John Cleese when I was little, and then I kind of moved over to Palin. And I met him, and he was... Have you met him?
I've only met him very briefly in a corridor, again, with my parents.
Right.
And my mum, like many mums of a certain age, I think, when he did his travel shows, had a real soft spot, a bit of a crush on Michael Palin.
Yeah.
And so I ran into Palin in this corridor, and I was with my parents, and I said, oh, this is my parents, and they're big fans. And my father immediately, having never met him before, immediately walked up and went, good to meet you, Michael. My wife's in love with you. and he was very sweet about it. Yeah. And,
he was very nice. So I'm very glad I didn't call him a paedophile. That might have been
That's always a great way to start.
Good start, yeah. But no, he was terrific. So yeah, I think you know it's difficult to know, isn't it? Difficult to know whether it will be a good meeting or a bad meeting. You're mixing. I mean, it's what's really interesting about you is that you feel very much ours still, and the Outlaws is set in Bristol. You're very proud of your upbringing and British, but you also are over in Hollywood and working with The Rock and all these different people. What people have you met that you were sort of in awe of, do you think, before?
I think, don't know about you, but the more you do these jobs, the more you realise, I don't know, I find it harder to retain I find it harder to idolise people now.
Yeah.
Because even if the people I've met that I admire, invariably there's something about them that you don't like, or they say something like, oh, that's a bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
or they're just kind of, they're just a bit weird, or they're just a bit difficult or whatever. So there's no one that I'm sort of in awe of now. But there are people that I've never worked with and I've only met in passing that I saw David Lynch, the director, once.
Okay,
I just did that thing where I literally went over and said, I don't want to interrupt you, Mr. Lynch, but I just want to say, you know, I'm a huge fan of your work. And then I left, and I realised in that moment that it was just for me. Like, it kind of didn't mean any... What did it mean to him? It's just somehow you and your teenage self needed to say it out loud, you know, to just I don't know, what make it real that you'd sort of encountered
him. I think it's
him,
worth doing. I mean, I once stood behind Rick Mayall in a petrol station, and he was my absolute comic hero. And I didn't say anything to him, and I really regret not just having that one opportunity to just go, hey, thanks. And that would have been all right, wouldn't it?
The biggest humble brag, not even a humble brag, the biggest brag I can ever... I don't think I've ever mentioned this before, but I ran into once a comedian called Bobcat Goldthwait. Do you know the comedian I mean? He was in Police Academy and things like that. And he was very close friends with Robin Williams. And I ran into him somewhere once, and he said to me, oh, I was having dinner once with Robin Williams, and you were sat next to us on a date And Robin Williams said to me, oh, that's this British guy. He's pretty funny, that guy. And I said, oh, Robin, you should say something. And Robin Williams said, no, I don't want to bother him. He's on a date. And never said anything, and I never met him, and then he died. And I was like, how would Robin Williams leaning over saying, I'm a big fan, be a problem on a date? Where, how did he think that was going to go wrong for me? So...
It feels... I'm glad that it feels like this, and I'm sure it isn't like this, but it just sort of feels like you're Bristol's Stephen Merchant and you being in that Hollywood world, it feels like a sort of slight disconnect, you know what I mean, between... Because I think you seem realer. You seem like more down-to-earth than some of those Hollywood stars. Yep. And I've sort of read a story about you going to a party and walking through a window and stuff like that. So,
Yes.
Are you managing to be cool amongst all these people?
No. No. That was a party thrown by the comedian Sarah Silverman.
Okay.
And I'd gone there not invited by her. I just went with a friend. And there was, because pot was I don't know if it was legal at the time, but it was certainly, popular.
Yeah.
And and there was some pot brownies. And someone said, do you want some pot brownie? And I thought, yeah, sure, because I'm 6'7", How was that going to affect me? And I ate this pot brownie and I immediately fell inside myself. Like my memory is that it was like I was trying to peek out through my own eyes, but I'd sort of shrunken inside myself. And I went and looked in the mirror at myself for a while, because that's the thing you want to do when you're really stoned, is stare into your own soul. And then I sort of remember I went out and I sort of lay down for a bit, but I'm 6'7", so I took up like 3 couches and people were like moving me out of the way. And then someone introduced me to Gary Shandling, the comedian, but I don't remember anything we said. And then the next thing I knew, I thought I'd get some air, and I went to walk outside to get a breath of fresh air. And the next thing I knew, an entire 6-foot plain glass window was smashing all around me. And I was like looking back into the party and everyone was staring at me and glass shards were falling around me. And you realise that you don't have any sort of social training for that. Do you know what I mean? You're not, like, what do? You just go, ta-da! Like, I had no... And then I just remember, then it's just like snippets. I remember kind of someone ordering me a cab, and then I remember being in the lobby of this apartment block because I was trying to wait for this cab, and then some new arrivals at the party were walking in and they didn't notice me. I just heard one of them say, hey, did you hear that some asshole just walked through a window? And then I just remember having a gash on my hand and my head. And then I remember thinking, oh, it's America, they're going to sue me. So then I wrote an email to Sarah Silverman saying, thanks for the party. Don't know if you noticed, I walked through a window. And really worried she was going to sue me, but she didn't, thankfully.
Did you pay for the window?
Of course not. No, okay. Not made of money. And then she... but then what was weird is even to this day, I keep meeting people who were there who have seen different versions of it from different angles. So I'm sort of still piecing it together.
Yeah.
Someone told me recently that I tripped on a cable, apparently, a TV kind of, cable plug-in. Right. And I tripped and I fell backwards through the window, which is why I wasn't more injured.
Yeah.
And so I keep hearing kind of your stories.
Sounds to me like you could sue Sarah Silverman.
That's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm wondering. Yeah.
I mean, it's likely that could have been it. That could have been the death of Stephen Merchant.
Yeah, or certainly kind of, stirred up and... and that sort of, I suppose, in a way, typified my experience of Hollywood, as you say. Yeah.
I mean, there's a bit...
I think I try to project myself with a cool when I'm there.
Yeah.
You know, like you reinvent yourself and then things like that happen and then you're back to square one.
It is, but it's sort of hard to, I'm from the West Country and it's hard to imagine West Country people in Hollywood. I say that, Cary Grant did okay. But like David Prowse and you.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine, you in a Hollywood party. And that's, I don't know if David Prowse, Darth Vader, Green Cross Man. We are getting old, aren't we? Have you noticed that when you do stand up and some of your references are now too old for most people?
Yeah, of course, Norman Wisdom.
Yeah.
I think it's the accent, right? It's the West Country accent. That,
it is.
That's why people... I saw someone had tweeted recently the David Prowse when he's doing the voice of Darth Vader. And, it's... Or I'm your father, Luke, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Which the legend is he didn't realise he was going to be revoiced by...
James Earl Jones, and it wasn't until he went to the premiere and he heard that he kind of was heartbroken, which is tragic, isn't it?
It's tragic, and it shouldn't be funny.
No, I know.
Nothing, no one voice isn't better than another.
But I've the one thing I've noticed is that in America, people don't notice the accent.
Right.
So they don't, they just, as far as they're concerned, I sound like Hugh Grant.
it's a dream come true. Would it have been when you were thinking I want to be a comedian? Were you thinking, and ultimately I want to go and be in Hollywood blockbusters and be in the movies? Or because to me that would have seemed.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I wouldn't have thought, oh, I'll go to Hollywood and be in a Marvel movie. They wouldn't have had to know what that was in 1977.
Yes.
But, you know, like, that wouldn't have been what I was hoping for. Was that what you
dreamt
of? Yeah.
I think it was just to have experienced it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think I ever thought I was going to be Harrison Ford, but I thought it'd be nice to go there and snoop around and be involved and, like you say, do a big budget film and realise that it's really boring and you don't, you know, rush to do it again and, you know, and meet people that you admire and work with people that you admire. And yeah, definitely. But I don't know it's funny you said that because I don't know why I thought that might be achievable.
Yeah.
I think it was the Cleese thing again. I think it was like, well, Cleese had gone off to Hollywood and he'd made films and stuff.
Yeah.
And he was in Cheers, I remember.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, well, he's from Weston-super-Mare. You know, like maybe tall people once in a generation, they get that chance. Like I must have had some, because I don't think I was an arrogant kid. I just must have thought that it was worth trying. It's strange, isn't it? Because it is a very arrogant assumption.
It is, but I mean, I think there's a I feel as I look back at, you know, the 90s and think, I mean, I was very insecure in a lot of ways, but we just had such confidence that we were the great, you know, that we were the best.
Yeah.
And that everyone else wasn't as good as what we were doing and, you know.
But were you Cambridge or Oxford?
Oxford.
So it didn't really come from that.
That didn't really give, because that didn't, because I wasn't public school.
Right.
And so Oxford kind of, again, dimmed my confidence and went to, I had a terrible time at the Edinburgh Festival as part of the Oxford Review, which actually kind of crushed me.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of things I wasn't confident about, but we had that, which I think reading interviews that you had with The Office, which, you know, turned out to be more justified than Vista Fun, but. You know, that you just sort of believed so much in the... I think having a partner in a partnership...
Well, that helps,
isn't it?
You just having a partnership, and I think also just the arrogance of youth, isn't it?
Yeah,
like you just don't know what you don't know. I mean, we had a meeting, I remember early on with the BBC, and they said, oh, this guy's going to be in it we've never heard of, and you're going to write it, and you're going to direct it. Why would we let you do this? And I remember saying to them, with not a shadow of irony, we might be the next Orson Welles. But I don't think I was thinking... I wasn't thinking, oh, we're definitely as good as Orson Welles. I think I was thinking, none of us know.
Yeah.
We haven't done anything. We might be.
Yeah.
I think there was that weird, it was like a weird inverse arrogance of like, I'm sort of untried, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember there's a phrase in filming when they start the camera before a take, you know, they say turn over.
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, just turn over, and that's the sort of terminology. And so I remember on the first day of The Office, we never directed anything. I gave a speech grandly to everybody, and I was like, I know we've never done anything before, but don't worry, we know all the terms. You know, action, cut, rollover. And the first AD went, turnover. I went, turnover. You know what I mean? But obviously, we thought we could do it. And I think it was very quickly we learned it was not as easy as it seemed.
Yeah.
You know. But at the time, it was like, yeah, of course you should give us a chance.
Sure.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah. And it's in, you know, I think you do need that, I think. I think that there needs to be a sort of belief in yourself. And I think, again, you did, you know, you were trying something that was new. I can sort of imagine, you know, I can imagine from the similar time with the executives, you know, you definitely go into those meetings knowing you know more about comedy than the person who's...
Right.
Who's going to tell you whether you can do your comedy or
right,
not.
Yeah.
So it's the, you know, there is an element of arrogance there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Let's talk about The Outlaws, which I thought the first series of was great. And also the second series is very good stuff. I'm sort of surprised. You've had this in your back pocket, this idea, really, because your parents did the job, right? So it's about people who have done minor crimes and are doing community service.
Yes, yes.
But your parents worked in that field, you know, not as people running those places.
Yes, they were
being at them. Yeah,
yeah, they weren't criminals, but they had done. They supervised offenders, as they called them at the time, and some of whom I went to school with, who would come through the ranks. There was one kid called Adam who was the world's laziest thief, and I remember my mother said to him once, "Why are you in again, Adam?" And he went, "Oh, I got caught stealing a TV." And what happened was he was stealing a TV from a house, and the homeowners came back, and they went, "Adam, what are you doing?" And he went, "I'm not Adam." And they went, "Yeah, you are. You live next door." And he couldn't even be bothered to go like a street across. And he was all. And I always remember thinking, even then as a kid, like, we're all putting our energies into trying to build jobs and careers and lives, right? And like. And you can't even do thieving well. Do you know what I mean? Like you're not even obeying any of the rules, and you're still a shit thief.
Yeah.
And I remember him, and my mother would tell me about other people that came through the doors, and I just thought it was an interesting backdrop for a story, right? Because you know you're always looking for reasons to bring people together in TV comedies and dramas and stuff, and people doing community service are so arbitrary.
Yeah.
You know, and they come from such different walks of life that it just always seemed like an interesting idea.
Yeah. You basically got, is it seven?
That's right,
it's sort of like, I mean, it's called The Outlaws, and there's a sort of Western...
Right.
I mean, Western and Western theme to it, and it's in Bristol, but it's sort of, you know, like a Sergio Leone film with people from Britain, like with Dave Prowse in it.
Well, I always wanted... Well, exactly, but I thought it was funny that, in their minds, the lives that they're living are... They're the centre of their own movies, right?
Yeah.
So in their mind, you know, what they're going through is kind of big and adventurous, and even though it's not, and it's quite parochial. And I like the idea of, like you say, applying the kind of grand music and sort of calling them the Outlaws and making it seem epic, but it's just sort of seven, you know, middle-class people or whatever from Bristol. I quite like that idea of sort of investing it with more weight and gravity than it deserves.
But it is, you know, it's a very...
Just on that point, do you think that's a very British thing, though? Because, like, again... In America, if you're making shows, they'll make shows about all kinds of towns. And do you know what I mean? And they just think, why wouldn't we tell you a story about this town?
Yeah,
I mean? Like, not every story is LA and New York.
No,
and we never think, oh, look at this loser town trying to put itself on the map. Do you know what I mean? But again, this is like a kind of British thing, isn't there? Why does Bristol deserve to be on TV or something?
Well, you know, I've always wanted to get I've always wanted to get Cheddar into stuff. So I've written about 5 sitcoms about Cheddar, none of which have been made. But you know, so it's great. No, it's lovely to see Bristol. Western Supermare's in it, so it's lovely to see Western Supermare station. They're going to Temple Meads as well, so it's all nice with that. But the characters are really great, and they are all different archetypes, different types. But it's also, you know, what I admired about it, I thought, is it's quite challenging. And I know you wrote this with someone else, right? So you've written it with Elgin. James. So, but you know, you're writing about drug deals, and you're writing about black people's lives, and you know, so it's quite a wide scope.
Yes.
And even like writing about someone on social, you know, like a social media star, those are things that could go badly wrong in the wrong hands, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, sure. But we had a not just me and Elgin, but a whole kind of writer's room of people to try and have all those different perspectives kind of covered. And Elgin himself sort of ran with gangs when he was growing up and was in jail, and you know, and so he's had a lot of experience of that stuff. So he, you know, I wasn't just kind of jumping into the world of sort of gang culture without any kind of reference points.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know. I mean, there's this argument about, are you allowed to write about things which aren't your direct experience? And I don't know. But we, that's why I tried to bring together like a, you know, a bunch of different people from different walks of life in order to try and kind of address that. And I learned a lot from it, you know. It's sort of like, I remember asking Elgin once, would a bunch of gang people in a gang just start sort of, you know, shooting a gun at like a bunch of sort of middle class people? And he said, well, they might do, and I said, but what about the consequences? And he went, but they don't think about the consequences, that's why they're in a gang.
Yeah.
And I was like, of course, because it's like, you know what I mean, like you come from that sort of cozy middle class world where everything is about the consequences and why you wouldn't do that and why you shouldn't, and sort of to sort of realize that there are people that just, for whatever reason, aren't thinking things through in that same way. It was quite somehow a revelation to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's very, there's a lot of comedy in it, but it's more of a
drama,
thriller,
I think.
Thriller and a drama than it is a comedy.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, it's impressive that I've got to be saying nice things about everything. But no, I really love the characters, and I particularly like the Rianne Barreto's character. Mm. Just the journey she takes over the two series is. And that, I suppose, again, in a sitcom, that wouldn't you couldn't have someone whose life, her life completely turns around.
Right.
From being an A-level student to suddenly kind of getting a taste for crime.
Right, right.
In a sitcom, you wouldn't really be able to do that, would you? Because everyone's sort of got to go back to where they were at the start of the episode, more or less.
Totally, yeah.
So it's kind of fun to be able to take...
Well, that was I thought of it much more like a crime thriller or something, but with some laughs along the way, rather than as a sitcom or something, you know. So... I'm quite proud of some of the kind of thrillery plotting, you know, because there's sort of seven characters and we had to, you know, come up with like a heist episode, and that was quite fun. Just the idea of trying to do Ocean's 11, but again, you know, in sort of Bristol.
Yes.
In the suburbs of Bristol seemed quite fun, you know.
And let's talk about Christopher Walken, which is kind of an incredible booking.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of like getting Marlon Brando to be in Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, how was this?
Sure.
How did this happen? Did you know? You didn't know him. Did you know him before?
No, he always wanted to work with me.
No.
I'd never met him. No.
So did you write it with him in mind? I mean, he's a fantastic in it. It's just, you know, it's just so great to see him walking around in Bristol and imagining him actually just having to walk around in Bristol as himself.
Right. Yeah. Well, no. He doesn't have a phone, cell phone, or a iPad or a computer or anything. So we had to fax him the scripts. And I'm not joking that. We had to sort of dust off an old BBC fax machine. I think the last fax that had been sent was Prince Andrew's Royal Variety performance invite. And we faxed him the script, and he liked it. And then I flew to America to talk to him. And, you know, I had to drive up to this little town where he lives. And, you know, it's quite intimidating. He was talking about kind of meeting people you admire.
Yeah.
And that's a good example because he plays obviously gangsters and toughs and stuff. So it's quite sort of, you know, he's quite sort of got that face and the voice and the whole thing. And and so I, you knocked on the door and he answered it. And then some guy had driven me up and he just sent the car away. He just drove off and I was just left with Christopher Walken in his house. And then he, the first, I can't do an impression, but the first thing he said to me was, would you like some of this omelette? And you know that situation where you've just had a big hotel lunch and you're not that hungry. And so I said, I'm good for omelette at the moment, thanks, Chris. And then we sort of sat there and he's quite very slow and thoughtful. So he'd like ask a question and then I would answer. Then he'd ask another question and I'd answer. And then he'd just sort of stare out into the garden for a bit. Then he'd ask another question. It was like having a conversation. It was like having a conversation in person on Zoom. Do you know what I mean? It felt like we were having, like, I wasn't sure if he was, you know, thinking or buffering. And and I was there for 3.5 hours and I was starving. And I said, any of that omelette left, Chris? And he served up the omelette and it was nice and fluffy. And he asked some more questions. And then I read an interview with him subsequently that the deal breaker was that I really liked his omelette. And I asked for seconds, and he thought, I need to work with this guy. Yeah, so But I think it's a good example of what you said before, really. She's like, you know, if you told me as a young man that I would one day go and, you know, have omelets with the guy who shoved a watch up his ass in Pulp Fiction, yeah. I'd have like, no, definitely not. But there it was. And then it was happening. And then he came to Bristol, like you said, and yeah. he did it, you know. And it's sort of, oh, yeah, he's an actor. And if he likes a script, he'd consider it. And there we were. And it did, you know, and I think at this point in my career, I'm like, yeah, that seems viable. You know what I mean? I know it seems, again, it's like, yeah.
I think also, like, if you don't, you know, it's the one of those things, if you don't ask, you don't get.
That's
so,
right.
Like, if you are, you know, you would just think, oh, there's no way he would do it. You know, that would, a lot of people would think that. So to.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, why not try, you know? And then there he was.
And so, because you did this, so lockdown happened in the middle of filming, right? So did he go home, or did he stay in Bristol for 2 years waiting for the series to
go back? He went back, and then we would bring him back when we could, you know? And then I'd sort of, you know, bigged up Bristol to him, you know? And I actually, at one point, I said to him, when I was trying to pitch it to him, I said, well, you're like Bristol. It's, you know, it's kind of quite, got a bohemian side to it, and it's quite hilly, and it's on the water, and there's a big bridge. It's exactly like San Francisco. And, but obviously I couldn't really even show him the glamour of Bristol, because it was all locked down. So he just had to sort of go back to his hotel. And one day he came in and he, do you know that show Naked Attraction?
Yeah.
I've never seen it, but he came in, he found himself watching a sort of Naked Attraction marathon. And he couldn't understand why there were penises and things on British TV. He was absolutely baffled by that.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, when I was a kid growing up in Bristol, never thought I'd be talking to Christopher Walken about Naked Attraction, or indeed would take Christopher Walken to Stonehenge, which we did. So, yeah, it's kind of extraordinary.
I mean, it's a shame, and maybe you did, but I'd quite like to just watch Chris Walken
watching Naked Attraction.
Just being in Bristol, just walking around Bristol and not talking to anyone.
Yeah.
And seeing how he reacted to Britain. That's a sort of another. Maybe we could get him back and do that next time.
Yeah, I suppose that could be Bristol. Like a kind of travelogue show.
Yeah.
And, but
did he like Stonehenge?
He did like Stonehenge, yeah. But he's a very quiet man. So we were there for about an hour, and then he just, out of nowhere, having said nothing the whole time, he just suddenly said, apparently the blue stones have healing properties. What? Sorry? And then he said to the woman showing us around, can I touch it? And it was so British, she went, no. And I just thought, it's amazing. Like, they've been there for sort of 5,000 years, and he's like never been there, and he's flown over from America, and he's like an icon, and she won't let him touch them. Like, because no one can touch the stones. Like, you know, I mean, what do they do? Like, take them in at night? Like, garden furniture? I mean, it's...
Used to be, when I first went to Stonehenge in the 1970s, I went with my grandparents. You could go right in, and I've got a picture of my granddad sitting on one of the ones...
Right.
...that's fallen down, so it's kind of... Yeah, I think the damage has been done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Christopher Walken should be allowed.
He should be allowed to touch. Them.
Be allowed
I
to
think
touch.
You can make exceptions.
He should. Well, I'll give a spoiler. I think there's a spoiler is out at the end of the first series. Christopher Walken's character paints over what looks like a real Banksy, which I understand is a real Banksy. There's a picture. Yes. They're repainting the community centre, and he knocks something down. There's a Banksy, and he's told to paint over it, and he does paint over it.
Yes, that's right. Yes. And it was a Banksy, yes. And it was reported in a few outlets that we had stumbled across a Banksy and painted over it, which would have been mental. So we somehow managed to find a go-between, because Banksy famously sort of began his career in Bristol, and there are still Banksys up and around Bristol. And we thought it'd be funny if, as you say, that Christopher Walken painted over a Banksy within the show, and that they didn't realise it was so valuable. And then we thought, well, we'll just do a fake Banksy. And then someone said, well, why don't we try and get the real Banksy to do it? And so I don't know him, and I've never met him, and people have obviously said, are you Banksy? And I'm neither going to deny or confirm that. All I'll say is I'm 6'7", and a lot of his art is quite high up. But we managed to find a go-between, and then we explained the idea to him, and he said, if I can do it, then I will. Where's your location? And then just one morning we came in, and he must have hopped the fence, you know, the night before, and there it was in the corner, and we covered it up, and we kept it hidden from all the cast and crew, because we were worried about kind of it leaking out. And then one day I went to Christopher in his trailer, and I was like, do you mind painting over a Banksy today? And he was like, yeah, you know, he's a man of few words. And so then we had to do it really quick. And obviously we only had the one take.
Yeah.
And he is a 78-year-old man. And I don't know if you've ever asked, you know, say your gran to do something. You know, there's a chance she may not get it right. Yeah. So, you know, you're a bit worried. But he nailed it and we destroyed the Banksy.
I mean, how does that... It's sort of KLF like there, right?
It is because a bit KLF, isn't it?
It's sort of like a... It is still worth loads of money.
Yes.
But then, in a sense, I mean, Banksy has destroyed some of his own works of art.
Well, that's basically why we thought he'd like the idea, and we liked the and the argument was that it would only exist in the show, and that therefore it was made for the show and it was destroyed for the show, and that was part of the whole thing, and that was, I think, the reason he agreed to do it. But yes, there obviously is a moment where you're looking at it thinking we could hack this off and pop down Sotheby's. But no, we yeah,
can't
we
you hack it. Off the painted over? I mean, wouldn't people still pay for the painted over?
No, because part of the deal was we had to make sure it was destroyed, so we had to come in with, like, you know, kind of concrete jackhammers and make sure it was fully destroyed. Yeah,
I'd still pay for that. I'd still pay for the broken remains. It is, you know, it's a thrilling moment. We've all dreamt about destroying the Mona Lisa.
Well, there you are. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'd like to.
When you saw it, did you believe it was real or did you assume it was a fake?
The Mona Lisa?
The Banksy.
Oh, the Banksy. I think I knew it was real.
Oh,
I think I'd read
real.
About
yeah,
it. Yeah. I think I knew it was real. But I still, it's a ballsy, there's a lot of ballsy stuff in this. I mean, I think I was saying you backstage in the second series, one of the characters is smoking crack and saying it's pretty good. It's quite ballsy. I mean, obviously it is quite good. That's one of its
appeals, apparently, is that it's, from what people tell me, it's really quite Moorish. And so it's a bit like a tin of Pringles. once you pop, you can't stop or whatever. So not to compare Pringles with crack. But I don't know, something about those TV shows where, you know, you're always supposed to kind of wag your finger and say, don't smoke crack. And it's like, well, of course you shouldn't smoke crack. Like, what do I need to explain that to you? I mean, if you're going to smoke crack, you're going to do it. I don't think me on a sitcom is going to persuade you one way or the other. I'm not sure.
It made me want to smoke some crack.
Did you?
Yeah. I'd never really thought about
it
before.
Do you know what? Years ago, I was working at Radio 1 and I had to do interviews with people who were doing recreational heroin smoking.
Right.
And I interviewed them and all of them described it. Completely separate people. They all described it as being like wrapped in cotton wool. I thought, that sounds lovely. That sounds delightful, doesn't it? And so I've never done the smack, but I can see why, because there's bound to be a reason why it's popular.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not. And I think that's the thing, is I feel like we grew up watching kind of Different Strokes and things where people would come on and go, or Grange Hill and go, wee.
Yeah.
And obviously that's as it should be. And of course you shouldn't be. I mean, a Grange Hill episode where they're going, you know, smack, you know, give it a try. We don't want to preach, you know, let you guys be the judge. But just say, maybe. But I just think, I don't know, it feels like for an adult show aimed at adults, I don't know, the idea that you then have to have like a disclaimer going, crack is really bad for you and your teeth drop out.
Well, the whole, you know, the whole second series is because you these characters have started out, you know, not, I mean, they've all done a crime, but often none of them are nasty people. And they make a decision that they, to save themselves, they need to start selling drugs themselves.
Yes.
And that is, you know, and some of them are going, no, my mum's a drug addict, we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
So it's this choice between, I mean, it's a big philosophical choice between good and evil and whether it's okay to be evil for a bit.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and it makes you feel, as a viewer, it makes you feel uncomfortable, as I'm sure it's meant to.
Well, indeed. Yeah, exactly. But I think also because the drug debate is always so sort of binary, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's the sort of that Daily Mail kind of all drug users and dealers are all evil, and it's this kind of like you've all sat down and kind of, you know, we're going to sell drugs to kids. Like, and it, as we know, people drift into it for all kinds of reasons, and it's not that sort of, it's not that clear cut why it happens. And the consumers are as guilty in a way as the sellers, right? So it's like it's a very grey area, and obviously some people feel it should be legalised and so on. So I don't know, it just seemed like it's a knotty idea about how you could find yourself as a perfectly, what you thought was a kind of, you know, a sort of law-abiding middle-class person suddenly sort of selling cocaine.
Yeah.
Just that seemed like an interesting.
No, it definitely is. I think if you do a third series, I'm sure there's a chance that will happen. I think it should start with the Dean just shooting all of the characters in the head.
Okay, all right.
Because that's what would happen. When he would just,
that
he
is
would
what
just,
would happen. Yeah.
We'd just kill them all, and then. I don't. I'm just giving.
It's
you
quite a brief
point.
Series. In
well,
that
that's
regard.
The starting. That's the starting point. They gets them in a room and goes, right, I've had enough, and shoots someone in the head.
Yeah,
they're all dead.
All right. Well, let's park that idea for now, and then.
just giving.
Are you a big drug man? Are you a big drug user?
I'm not.
Have you ever been a big drugs guy?
I've not really been into drugs. I don't even drink anymore. So God, I've stopped drinking. I've had a couple of cocaines in my life.
You have some cocaines, yeah.
A couple of cocaines.
Yeah.
And I the old wacky backy.
The old wacky backy, But never the old smack or the crack?
Never had a smack.
No.
I had half ecstasy tablet.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And how did that go for you? Was that fun?
It was all right, that was okay.
Yeah.
I had some magic mushrooms at Glastonbury.
Yeah, nice.
And I felt like I was lying down on the ground looking at the sky, and it felt like I was in the sky looking at the sea.
Oh, that's nice.
That's quite nice. Yeah.
And last time you interviewed me, what were you on then?
That was just pure...
Adrenaline,
the love of performing. Hey, look, there's a lot of things to talk to you about. I'll ask you a couple of emergency questions. We got the main ones in last time. Have you tried to suck your cock in the last 10 years?
What were they? I can't remember them last time.
You asked if you'd ever tried to suck your own cock, and you hadn't.
Still haven't tried yet. Sorry about that.
That's all right. I think I asked about ghosts. I won't ask you that. Is there anything you'd like named after you? So I want to get the. I've been trying to get the external meatus, which is the aperture at the end of the penis.
Oh yeah.
Named after me. When we were kids, we used to call it something that was. It's insensitive.
And what?
Insensitive. I want it to be called the herring's eye.
Oh, the herring's eye.
Yeah, because it looks like a sort of fish's mouth, really, doesn't it?
But it wasn't because I wondered if it was something to do with the fact your name's obviously abbreviated to Dick and whether that
no, it wasn't that. Was something no, to do just with it. You know, I think
the herring's eye.
I've done a lot of work with the penis, both like practically and theoretically. I just would like
you,
to be.
Can you suck your own? Or
I could get the herring's eye in.
I mean,
back in the day.
Now, who is keeping you from naming it the herring's eye? I mean, is there? Is there a committee that's very against the idea?
No one's stopping it, but no one's taking. Why? People have to start using it for it. Then it will go in the dictionary. I've had Susie Dent on. I don't know if I asked her this directly. I probably did, to be fair. It would be a waste of time having her on and not asking her.
Well, if it's helped, then I'll certainly start referring to it as the herring's eye. And why specifically that was.
Because the name for it we have is not. Good. I mean, the external meatus is not a good name, and the other name is inappropriate. Yeah. So it's there to be named.
Yes. Well, good luck.
You know, because it's there, that is why.
Yeah, no, I get
that's
it.
Why,
I get it.
That's why I wanted to name
that. Good luck with that, yeah.
Thank you.
I would quite like a statue at some point in Bristol.
Yeah.
There's one of Cary Grant, so I wouldn't mind that at some point.
Well, that might happen. I mean, that's...
It's a lot of bronze, though, isn't it?
If it's
life size.
They could do a very small version of it.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love that. I was a little bit disappointed when I went back to do the second series and there wasn't a sort of ticker tape parade.
Yeah.
I think it was because it was COVID.
Yeah,
I would
assume. It probably was COVID.
That's what it was.
It'll happen. I'm sure it will happen.
It'd be nice though, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, Bristol's very... Have you been knighted by the Queen?
I haven't, but I don't do enough for charity. This is one of the problems. I'm really sloppy with the charity work, you know? Just find it a lot of effort. And I think that's one of the things you've got to... And I've done some, but I've kept it quiet. Yeah. I've been one of those guys that doesn't make a song and dance about it. And I'm a fool to myself, really, because I'd love... I mean, at the very least, a CBE. Have you got anything?
No.
It's unlikely they're going to give it to you, isn't it?
I
just mean because you're talking about penises.
I know.
You know what I mean?
They did. My friend, who sadly since died, worked in the Foreign Office, and he... was going to suggest because of my international thing I do on International Women's Day where I'd raise quite a lot of money for refuge because I do a lot for charity.
Yeah, yeah.
He rang up my wife because you have to want it to be nominated, but you can't ask someone if they want to be nominated. So he rang my wife to say, do you think Rich would like to be nominated for an MBE? And my wife said, no. And then he died, so, you know.
Yeah.
Fucker.
Would you have liked them here?
Nice to get something, wouldn't it? Nice to get Something in the, I don't, you know, it's a, but it's that, is that thing, because it's so to Alan Cumming has just given his back.
Yeah. I mean, but it'd be nice to have the opportunity.
It'd be nice to give it back. Get it, give it back,
and then give it back.
Just find the moment.
Or just refuse it.
Yeah.
And then just sort of mention it occasionally on podcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah, they offered it. I didn't.
I mean, I was a long way away from getting it. Right. Who is the most right-wing person that you are sexually attracted to?
Who's the most right-wing person that I'm sexually attracted to?
I find them all quite sexy.
Yeah. Well, there is that sort of, isn't there that idea that you should sort of vote left but party with the right? Isn't there like some phrase like that or something? Because they're always so decadent, aren't they?
They're mean.
Well, yeah, but they're throwing parties when we're all locked down, and they can't stop having parties, and they're all sort of, they've all got like weird drug habits. A lot of them have done the cokes and the smacks.
They definitely have, yeah. They say we can't do it, and then they do it.
That's right. So I'm trying to think. I don't know that, I'm not that familiar with everyone's sort of politics.
Okay. Hitler's quite right wing.
Yeah.
Hitler.
No,
I could get you to say that on the podcast. That'd probably get in the newspapers.
No, I'm. Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say that I don't find Hitler sexually attractive. Okay. I think that's. I'm going to. I know that I might get some angry tweets.
I can still have Stephen Merchant considers whether Hitler is sexually attractive.
Yeah.
All right, I'll do one more. I'll do a nice fanciful one. If you if you could go into a chrysalis like a caterpillar does,
into what, a chrysalis?
Yeah, and pupate.
Yeah.
And dissolve. A caterpillar dissolves and comes out as a butterfly. You can choose what you're going to come out of that chrysalis as. It can be anything you want. What would you come out of the chrysalis as?
Even taller. Like properly mental size, like 9 foot, like 9 foot tall.
I mean, it must be annoying to get so tall but not be the tallest person.
That's
ever.
Right. It's really galling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I've gone to basketball games in America, and I like going to basketball games because I'm among my people. But they're all like 7 foot. They're 7 foot two. They're giants. I feel like a titch. So I quite like the idea of being
really
even
taller.
Yeah. What about you? What's your?
I would like to be really tall. I'd like to be 5'10", though. I'd be happy with that.
Well, that's a good height, because obviously I've been most people's heights.
Yeah.
And
it's a good time.
It's a great time. And I can tell you right now, 5'10"'s good, but if there's anyone out there, I would say the best height to be as a man, 6'4".
Right.
Excellent height. I don't know if there's any 6'4"'s in.
Yeah.
Terrific height. Most things you can still buy, shoes, clothes, everything. Beds are still the right fit, but it's a very masculine height. You take a lot of control. And then 6'5", it's all right, okay. And then 6'6", you're like, slow down now, this is mental. And then 6'7" is just a joke. It's just it's absurd. It's really, really annoying.
Well, you might still grow. It might be a spurt. I'm hoping for a spurt. But look, there's so much else to talk to you about. I loved you in Jojo Rabbit. That was amazing. I love that film. Talking of Hitler, played a Nazi, and you seem to be going sort of into some more serious roles. You did Four Lives, which was obviously a very serious.
Yes.
Was that always on the agenda, or is?
I just think as time's gone on, I felt. I don't know, more confident as an actor.
Yeah.
And that someone offered me the chance to play that character, Stephen Poore. What do I say character? He's a real person and a real murderer who's in jail. And it was a very serious role and no humour in it. And obviously I was kind of nervous about that and taking on something like that. And I hope I did a good job. I enjoyed it. I don't mean it's not enjoyable to play a killer, but it's enjoyable to have the challenge of that. And what I realise is you don't know what a killer is thinking. You have no sense, having not been able to speak to them and not wanting to speak to them. You've no idea of what their brain is thinking at any moment. And so when you're playing it, you sort of have to, in a sense, write in your head what you think they're thinking.
Right,
And so in the way that I find writing very nutritious and meaty and kind of challenging, I found that was the first time I'd found acting kind of equally stimulating, I think, in that way. So I wouldn't mind doing some other serious stuff. Yeah.
Well, hopefully, someone else will kill a load of people you can play. That's gross.
who's also tall and a bit weird looking.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. Maybe if you killed some people, then you could play yourself and know what you felt like when you killed the people. Probably going, oh, this is horrible. Why am I doing this?
Sure. Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm beginning to sense why those sitcoms set in Cheddar aren't getting made.
Look, I just said all the characters should die in the first minute.
Yeah, and that I should commit murders to get...
you were on Logan.
Yes.
You played Caliban.
Yes.
I haven't seen this one. Is there any relation to Caliban from The Tempest? Which I
don't think so. I think he's probably named after him in some distant comic book. Somewhere.
You worked with Richard E. Grant on that film.
I did.
Yeah,
I did.
My interview with him went well. I thought it went well actually, but
what happened with
he wouldn't let me put it out.
Oh goodness, right. Yeah. What had you done?
I don't know. Didn't even call him a paedophile.
right. I mean, he hasn't mentioned it to me. I don't know why.
I think it was after you worked with him. Yeah. You see him again.
I'm interested to know what you had done.
I don't think I did anything. There's people here who were there. It was good, wasn't it?
I mean, you've done like 450 of these now.
Done a lot, yeah. I mean, probably over 500 if you include everything, yeah.
And yet you are consistently offending guests. It's quite a... I mean, it's a wonder
I'm upset if I've upset him. Because, like, he's sort of out of my normal remit.
Yeah.
So, like, I thought if it goes well with him, then, I might get some other big Hollywood stars and stuff coming into it. But, you know, I don't know. He hasn't said really said...
Yeah.
I mean, they said loads of reasons, but none of them. I would question all the reasons, and then they go, oh, no, we still can't put it out.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, I think you've got to just take a long look at yourself, really, and just
wonder, think about it.
Is it his fault or is it yours? I suppose is the question. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do that later. I'm going to have a good, hard look at myself. So, walking in Bristol, it could be like, walking in Bristol. Could do that. It could be the theme tune to it.
Should we wrap this up now?
No, you could do.
Do you want to start insulting me now? I feel like you're building to it. Haven't got there.
Just seeing if there's anything else that I wanted to talk to you about.
Yeah.
I'll ask you another emergency question.
Sure.
That's what they're here for.
What was your favourite interview that you've done in all those?
I think Michael Palin.
Was it Palin?
Yeah, because he was so nice and he was, everything that I wanted.
Yeah.
He's you're really good too, Stephen, but he's my sort of hero, comedy hero.
No, I'm interviewing him for the Bristol Slapstick.
Oh, yeah, great.
And I've except for that brief encounter, I've never spoken to him before.
He's really good. What I liked about him was he was very keen to just do old sketches and stuff, which like a lot of people, he would start quoting bits of old sketch, which you'd think if you're in Monty Python, you go, I do not want to.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do the Spanish Inquisition. I'm not going to do it again. Are you that kind of, if people come up, and is there a bit that people ask you to do if you're in the street, they go, oh, it's Stephen Merchant? Is there a bit that people want? There isn't really.
Not really,
like a signature.
No, I haven't got my garlic bread or, that bit. I sometimes just get really weird. Like sometimes I'll just have
office.
Okay. Yeah. Got nothing to come back to, and I think I also kind of get quite a lot of sort of white van drivers. Yeah. Just sort of shouting out. Like I had one recently. It was just like, here's a lanky streak of piss. Steve, love you, mate. It's such a uniquely British thing, that, isn't it? The kind of insult followed by the good one, mate.
Yeah. I don't. Is it hard for you to go? It must be hard for you to like be incognito in public, that of everyone, just because of the sheer size of you.
Yes. Well, that's why I don't go to Glastonbury anymore, because that's quite intense. And I, the last time I went to Glastonbury was to see the boss, Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
And got down there, and it was quite intense because obviously he's so tall. And then my friend was supposed to organise the tent. And he, for some reason, screwed up. And so I found an old tent in the back of the cupboard that has never been used. And I took it down and I opened it up and it was like those old sort of Girl Guide, you know, the kind of carry-on camping tents with the poles and the, you know, which I didn't realise was not a thing now. I guess they're all kind of pop-up sort of igloo-type tents. And so I've had to kind of, and people were kind of literally walking by, like Nelson from The Simpsons, like, hey, just laughing as I was trying to assemble this tent. And then I got it up and it was a one-person tent. And I couldn't fit in it without my feet poking out the end.
Yeah.
So then I crawled into this tent after Springsteen. I'm just lying there, and I could just hear people like in the tents next door going, "You know, you know, in that tent next door is that lanky bloke off the telly. You know, go and have a look." And so I'd just be lying there trying to sleep, and then they just hear zzzz. People just open it up and just, "Oh, it is him! It is him! Look, yeah, it's..." And it just went on for like hours and hours, just people coming by like I was like, you know, like in a Victorian freak show. And in the end, at like 3 a.m, I couldn't bear it. I just left. I abandoned the tent. I mean, wow. I know it's not very eco, but I just left the tent there and left. Yeah. And I assume it's still there. And people are welcome
probably
to
is.
It. Yeah.
In the Outlaws, when you in the nightclub and you get tangled up in the chandelier. Is that something? It felt like that might have been something that.
No, but that was like that was sort of thing was inspired by the walking through the glass at Sarah Silverman's. In that, you know, people always think that when you do a sort of a pratfall or some kind of physical bit of comedy, that somehow it's too broad and that would never happen. But patently would happen.
Yeah.
Because it's happened to me many times. So I mean, I'm always hitting my head on, you know, low hanging lights and, you know, whatever it might be. So yeah, no, of course that would definitely happen.
Must be nice to snap the other half live up in the sky. Look, it's really lovely for you to come on. I will, you know, another 10 years, I will build up my courage and be rude to you. Next, I hope I have been acceptable this time. Remember, if you don't want it to go out, you can do a Richard E. Grant and just say, it's not going out.
I'm not wasting my time for a second time. Let's put it out. God.
I hope
how has it gone for you? Have you
today this one? It's been okay. Yeah. It's been okay.
What were you hoping for that hasn't happened?
I think you've been very funny. You know, it's brought up a lot of the feelings from 10 years ago. I was a little traumatized by the by it 10 years ago. I didn't mean to upset you.
Yeah.
Well,
you were playing a character. I mean, we wanted to know. It sounds like you didn't realize either.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. In the early days of it, obviously, like this is a bit too successful to come on and get people who are more successful than you and be rude to them.
Yeah.
And in that sort of what you know, because I can't really do that anymore. So it has changed a little bit since then. So I think there was an element of that. There was a sort of joke where the joke was, you know, why are you doing so well? I'm doing this stupid podcast.
Right.
But
right.
Now the podcast is doing all right, so I can't do that anymore.
No, right. Of course. Yeah.
It's not like I'm in a Hollywood party walking through people's windows.
Not
that successful. But it's going all right. But no, it's, you know, it's nice. I'm really glad you came back.
Well, thanks for having me.
And thank you for everything you've done. Apart from the second series of extras, which is which I did actually enjoy. Never mind. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause for the... No. No, Richard. For the amazing Stephen Merchant! Stephen! You have been listening to Ralastapur with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Stephen Merchant. The music is by Scant Regard. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one or that one. Thank you to Ben Evans, not that one. And thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre. It's delightful to be back in this beautiful theatre. Thank you to Kathleen McKeegan for her research on Hullisper.com. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Hold up. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And GoFasterStripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. Do come and say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.